Opening narration.
The Ekhatra Foundation presents the Ekhatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekhatra AI.
Introduction.
Welcome, everyone, to the Ekhatra Dialogue. Today, we're stepping into a world conjured by perhaps one of the most famous opening lines ever written. I had a farm in Africa at the foot of the Nongong Hills.
Ah, yes. Instantly recognizable. We're talking about Out of Africa, of course. And the remarkable woman behind it, Baroness Karen von Blixenfeneke, or Isaac Dineson, as she's better known.
Exactly. And her story, her time in Africa, it's more than just a memoir, isn't it? It feels significant even now.
Oh, absolutely. It's this incredibly lyrical elegy, really. A look back at a time, a place, even a version of herself that was completely lost. Its power, I think, comes from how it pulls you into this world gone now, but so vivid, almost timeless.
Painted with memory, like you said.
Right. And it digs deep, you know, into destiny, culture, landscape. It's quite philosophical, beyond just the narrative. That's where we're diving in today, sort of unpack that enduring magic.
The chronological journey.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Who was Karen Blixen before Africa, this Danish aristocrat writing under a man's name?
Well, she was born in 1885, died in 62. Danish, an author, a storyteller, but also, unexpectedly, a coffee farmer. Her background is key, though.
How so?
She grew up at Rungstedland, this privileged estate. Her father, Wilhelm Dineson, was quite a figure, adventurer, writer, lived with Native Americans, but he died by suicide when she was only 10.
Wow, that must have left a mark.
A huge one. It sort of linked adventure and tragedy early on in her mind, perhaps. Her mother, Ingeborg, was different progressive Unitarian ideals, but quite strict morally. And Karen herself had this unconventional art education in Copenhagen, Paris, Rome.
Shaping her eye for detail, maybe, the way she describes things later.
Exactly. That aesthetic sensibility is all through her writing. Then came her rather complicated romantic life.
Ah, yes. The path to Africa wasn't straightforward, was it?
Not at all. A thwarted love for her cousin Hans led, strangely enough, to her marrying his twin brother, Baron Broa Blixenfeneke, in 1914. It was very much a marriage of convenience.
And that was her ticket to Africa.
That was the doorway. Imagine it, this European aristocrat arriving in British East Africa. Talk about a culture shock, bringing her fine china and poetry into the wilderness.
It was a complete break from her past.
Totally. A reinvention, almost.
Yeah.
And the struggle started pretty quickly. The plan was a dairy farm, but Broer, well, he was more interested in hunting and less in the details of business.
So the coffee plantation fell to her.
Pretty much. She found herself managing this huge 6,000-acre coffee farm, and it was incredibly difficult. Wrong altitude for coffee, unpredictable weather, labor issues, money problems. It was a constant battle.
Yet she became this figure, the Memsahib.
Yeah.
More than just the boss, right?
Oh, much more. She became a kind of local institution. She'd doctor people, settle disputes among the Kikuyu squatters on her land, even taught the children. It went way beyond just owning the place.
And the relationship she formed there seemed crucial. Farah Aden, Kamonte.
Absolutely central. Farah, her Somali majordomo, he was her confidant, fiercely loyal. And Kamonte, the cook she'd cured as a boy, he became this brilliant, if sometimes difficult, chef. These weren't just staff. They were deep, complex bonds.
It sounds like she created her own unique world there.
She really did. Governed by her own sort of aristocratic code, honor, courage, loyalty, responsibility. And she had this deep reverence for the land itself, the Ngong Hills especially. She saw nature as a major character in her life story.
Admiring Maasai and Kikuyu for their connection to it all.
Yes, though we'll touch on the complexities of that later. But fundamentally, she felt a kind of stewardship. And it was here, amidst all this, that she really became a storyteller.
Entertaining guests, like Denise Finch Hatton.
Exactly. Storytelling became her art, her way of making sense of things, of connecting. The writer Isaac Dineson was truly born in Africa long before the books.
Which brings us to those golden days and Denise Finch Hatton. He seems pivotal.
Hugely. This English aristocrat, hunter, pilot, he became her intellectual soulmate, maybe her romantic one too. He shared her love for Africa, for books, music. He brought his gramophone, remember?
Mozart in the Ngong Hills.
Right. He wasn't just a companion. He was her audience, her critic. Mm. He really nurtured that artistic side of her. He saw her genius, I think.
And the farm became a kind of salon.
In a way, yes. Friends like Berkeley Cole would visit. There were safaris, evenings filled with music, deep conversations. It was a time she felt truly belonged, creating this little kingdom.
You mentioned Lulu, the antelope, as a symbol of that.
Yes, that story is wonderful. She raised this bush buck, Lulu, who eventually went back to the wild but would still visit. It's like her relationship with Africa itself. You can love something wild deeply, but you can never truly own it. It follows its own path.
Like playing classical music for the Kikuyu staff, the music that speaks.
Yeah, another great anecdote. They associated pieces with her stories. It just shows how art can bridge divides, connect on a really fundamental human level. Music, memory, story, all intertwined.
Core philosophy and values.
So beyond these amazing stories, what was the core philosophy driving her through all this? The good times and the bad.
It's a really unique blend. You've got this aristocratic romanticism, this deep love for nature, but it's all underpinned by a strong sense of destiny, almost fatalism.
The idea that God loves a story.
Exactly. She saw life as this grand narrative. Individuals have roles to play, and you play them with courage, with grace, even the tragic parts. Tragedy wasn't just random awfulness. It was part of the pattern, part of the beauty, in a way.
So values like courage, loyalty.
Magnanimity, definitely. Facing hardship with a certain style, almost. It was very much part of her aristocratic upbringing, adapted to the African context.
How did that play out when things got really tough? Her attitude towards adversity.
Stoicism is maybe the word. She saw challenges as tests of character. Not something to whine about, but something to endure, to find meaning within. You know that famous quote.
The cure for anything is salt water, sweat, tears, or the sea.
That's the one. It sums it up perfectly. Engage with the struggle. Face it head on. For her, writing itself became a form of that engagement, especially later, turning the salt water of tears into the ink of her stories.
Transforming loss into art became her way through.
Absolutely. That was her ultimate recovery strategy.
Three pivotal turning points.
Okay, let's pinpoint three moments that really shifted the direction of her life, these huge turning points. The first seems to be the break with her husband, Broer.
Yes, definitely. Their separation and later divorce in 1925 was critical. Broer's infidelity and financial carelessness were one thing, but him giving her syphilis that had lifelong health consequences for her.
Terrible. And the divorce forced her hand with the farm.
Completely. She took over sole management of the Karen Coffee Company. Suddenly, she wasn't just the Baroness. She was the one responsible for everything, everyone. It forced an independence and a deeper connection to the place and its people that might not have happened otherwise. It really forged her.
Okay. Turning point one. Taking sole command. What's the second?
I'd say the deepening relationship with Denise Finch Hatton, especially after Broer was less in the picture. His arrival, using her farm as his base.
Bringing the gramophone in the conversation.
And crucially, seeing her, not just as a hostess, but as an intellectual equal, a storyteller. He encouraged her writing, listened to her tales. He validated her artistic self in a way that was probably transformative. He brought that intellectual vibrancy, that deep connection, marking those golden days.
So independence first, then this profound intellectual and maybe romantic partnership. And the third turning point.
Yeah.
It's devastating one, isn't it? 1931.
Yeah. 1931 was the year it all fell apart. A double blow. First, the farm finally went bankrupt. Bad luck, bad conditions, the Great Depression, all of it. 17 years of work, gone. Her role as provider, protector, shatter.
Just devastating financially and emotionally.
And then, almost unbelievably, the second blow. May 14th, 1931, Denise Finch Hatton died in a plane crash.
Oh.
It was more than losing a lover. He represented that whole romantic ideal of Africa for her. The freedom, the intellect, the untamed spirit, his death, and his burial in the Nungong Hills. It was the end of an era, the end of her Africa.
So the farm lost, the great love lost.
Everything. This double catastrophe forced her to leave Africa. She returned to Denmark utterly changed, carrying this immense grief and sense of failure. But crucially, she also carried the memories, the raw material for out of Africa.
And even as she was leaving, she fought for her workers, right?
That's such an important point. In those final awful months, she battled legally to try and secure land and future employment for her Kikuyu staff. It shows how far she'd come, from colonial manager to advocate, trying to work within a system that ultimately limited her power to protect them fully.
That act speaks volumes about her character.
It really does. That sense of responsibility endured even in her darkest hour.
Human lessons and reflection.
Her life is just extraordinary, full of such highs and lows. What can we, living now, take away from her journey? What are the human lessons here?
Well, one big one is about embracing loss, isn't it? Not just enduring it, but seeing it as a potential catalyst. She turned absolute devastation into her life's great work. It shows that maybe our deepest wounds can become our greatest strengths. creatively at least.
The redemptive power of making something out of the wreckage.
Exactly. And another thing, I think, is about finding the extraordinary in the ordinary, or maybe the mythic in the everyday. She had this way of seeing her life, the people, the land, with such depth and significance.
Like finding poetry in the daily grind of the farm.
Yes. It's a call to look at our own lives, our own surroundings, with that same kind of attention, maybe, to see the bigger story we're part of.
And what about belonging? She lost the farm, she left Africa, but that connection remains so powerful.
That's the third thing, I think. True belonging isn't just about owning a piece of land or having papers. It's deeper. It's spiritual, emotional. Her connection to Africa was forged through love, through understanding, through shared experience. And that couldn't be taken away even when she physically left. It lived on inside her and then in the book.
Three final takeaways.
Okay, before we wrap up, let's distill this down. If you had to give our listeners three key takeaways from Karen Blixen's life and Out of Africa, what would they be?
Right. Okay, three takeaways. First, an emotional insight. It's about the profound, almost heartbreaking beauty of loving something, a place, a person, a time that you know you are destined to lose. There's a nobility she finds in carrying that grief, in honoring the memory. The story of the loss becomes as important as the loss itself.
That resonates. Okay, second.
Second, an intellectual insight. Her view of life as a story governed by destiny or fate. In a world where we often strive for control, her perspective invites us to see meaning even in setbacks, to view our lives as narratives where every event, even the painful ones, contributes to the overall plot. It's about finding pattern and significance.
Seeing the bigger picture, even when it hurts.
Yeah.
And the third.
Third, a universal insight. This has to be the transformative power of art, of creativity. She lost almost everything tangible, the farm, the relationship, her health was fragile. But through writing, she didn't just cope. She created her legacy. She proved that catastrophic failure can, paradoxically, be the source of your greatest triumph. That act of creation is profoundly redemptive.
Closing narration.
Dinesen wrote, "Up in this clean air you breathed easily, drawing in a vital assurance and lightness of heart. In the highlands, you woke up in the morning and thought, here I am where I ought to be." We encourage you to reflect on where you feel that profound sense of belonging and what stories you're uniquely positioned to tell.
This deep dive into Karen Blixen's Out of Africa reveals that even in profound loss and failure, there is an enduring beauty and the opportunity for transformative creation. What resonates most with you from her remarkable journey?
Join us next time for a new episode, featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.